I'm Rick Steves. This is Travel with Rick Steves. Today we're going to Britain. We're going specifically to the Celtic corners of Britain, and that's Wales and Scotland. And I'm joined by two guides, Anne Doig from Scotland and Martin Delandowitz from Wales. Thanks for joining us, you guys.
Thank you for having us.
Now, you're both Celtic, and you're both British.
Yep.
And do you see yourself as, in Wales and Scotland, as sort of Celtic brothers and sisters? How does that work?
Well, yes, I think we do, especially when it comes to playing any kind of sports. If we're playing rugby, all the Celtic countries sort of stay together. Like we say in Scotland, Scotland supports two teams, Scotland and whoever else is playing against England.
Oh, okay.
If you take Britain, you have Wales and Scotland. But then, of course, if you take the United Kingdom to that, we add Northern Ireland. But in the British Isles, of course, it's all of Ireland, mm-hmm. Scotland, and Wales. They're linguistically and ethnically different to the rest of Britain, i.e. England.
And then Great Britain would add Northern Ireland.
No. Great Britain is still the island of Britain.
The United Kingdom is Northern Ireland.
Northern Ireland, yeah.
And then Great Britain would be both of the islands together, all those people.
Yeah. No, that's the British Isles.
I'm sorry, it's confusing, isn't it?
It's very confusing.
Don't forget Cornwall, though. The Cornish.
Now, the Cornish people are Celtic.
Celtic, yeah.
But the last Cornish speaker died, didn't he?
Yeah.
Does anybody speak Cornish?
I think it's very much on the table being given CPR.
Oh, they're trying to bring it back.
Oh, absolutely.
We've got Celtic people in France.
That's true. The Bretons are the closest living language to Welsh.
To Welsh. More close to Welsh than to Irish?
Oh, much closer, much closer. They are two branches of Celtic language. There's Q-Celtic and P-Celtic. And the Welsh are P-Celtic, as are the Bretons, whereas the Irish and the Scots are Q-Celtic.
And then Anne reminded me we've got Spain, Galicia, right?
Galicia, yeah.
And they speak Gallego?
Uh-huh, which is the Celtic language. And they've got pipes and lots of Celtic icons, too.
And we're missing the Isle of Man.
Of course.
Is that Celtic?
Q-Celtic. It's in between. Manx. It's one of the ironies, isn't it? Yeah, Manx is transportation of Irish via the Isle of Man.
So that's the Celtic crescents all around England.
That's
now,
right.
Is my understanding correct that the Angles came over a long time ago, Angles and Saxons,
yes.
From Germany or something?
Mm-hmm. From Friesland, yeah.
Is it fair to say that the Celtic people were living all over Britain, the British Isles,
yes.
And then the people from Europe came in, the bullies came in and took the best land and
pushed
gave you guys the rocky stuff?
Yeah. That's right.
That's really what it is, isn't it?
Yeah, mm-hmm. I mean, you know, if you look at the Angles, the Saxons, the Frisians and the Jutes, England, with its deep soil, its better climate, is of use to them. One of the many things that Scotland and Wales have in common is very thin, acid soil and very small
hills.
Sheep. And that's about it.
Small sheep and acidic soil. Oh, my goodness. How are the Scots and the Welsh? You're both Celtic, but how do you differ if you were to generalize?
Well, I would say, A, that we're half the size geographically and in terms of our numbers in population of Scotland. Scotland is a very big country. If you take a tape, and, you know, the listeners can do it at home, take an atlas of the British Isles, stretch it from the south coast to the southern border of Scotland, now do the same from the south of Scotland to the north, and you find there's very little difference in size. It's a big country in terms of Britain.
So Hadrian's Wall cuts the island of Britain in half, essentially.
In effect. I mean, the Scottish border is slightly to the north.
And the high culture is the area to the north of that line.
Oh, absolutely.
Yes, absolutely.
What are the Scottish people and most proud of in their culture?
I think possibly their history, the fact that they were never really completely dominated by England. They won the Battle of Bannockburn and the Braveheart thing, and that they voluntarily united with England in 1707 and have got that independence back. And I think they're very proud of their musical traditions and storytelling traditions and things that are very deep-seated in the culture.
And literature, I think.
Literature, sort of.
I think you had to be good students to make it under London's rule.
Yes.
There's a real emphasis on reading.
Well, education, that kind of came out of the Reformation because John Knox wanted everyone to read so they could read the Bible.
Okay.
So the break from the Catholic Church. So yes, we always had a very good reputation for education, and it's very important to the people of Scotland. In fact, Queen Victoria said that our finest buildings were not necessarily our castles and palaces, but more likely to be banks and schools, money and education. Very important to Scottish
And you go
people.
To Edinburgh, you see that.
Yeah.
You see that. When Scottish people look at these popular movies, Rob Roy and...
Braveheart.
do you think those are good movies? Do they do well for Scotland?
They did, yeah. I think Braveheart brought back a lot of national feeling. Not necessarily was a great thing because the people in England didn't like Braveheart at all.
Right.
But yes, it did give people a feeling of national pride. Yeah.
And now Scotland has its parliament again.
Yeah.
For the first time in what? 300 years. Why did London let you have your parliament back?
Well, I think it was the Labour Party. They thought it was a stepping stone rather than having complete separation. It's a devolved parliament within the United Kingdom. People support the union, some people support complete independence. Mm-hmm. So the idea was Tony Blair's idea. It was a referendum and it would sort of prevent this movement for complete separation.
So that's called devolution?
It's called devolution.
Does that mean giving power back to the regions?
Yes. It's the opposite of federalism.
So it's a pragmatic thing. London said, well, there's going to be some angry people wanting out and out independence. If we give them their parliament and we still control big picture things, defence or whatever.
That's right.
That'll be sustainable.
Security.
And now you've got this glorious new parliament building.
Yes.
And has that quelled the secessionists?
Not really, actually.
There's serious secession talk in Scotland?
Well, the new Scottish Parliament, the last vote was in May, and by one seat the Scottish Nationalists got in. By one seat.
Wow.
So it's a proportional type of representation they were voted on. So they have to govern with alliances with other parties.
Right, coalition.
Yeah.
With the establishment of the European Union, isn't it becoming a non-issue? And London's going to kind of wake up and realize it doesn't really matter because...
Well, no, because people are beginning to think that we'd do better independent within Europe. So there's no more British Empire. I mean, the Scots are very canny. When we united with England, the country became very prosperous. We had access to the British Empire. There's no empire any longer, so we don't need it. But if we're independent within Europe, Norway does well, Ireland's done brilliantly, the Celtic tiger economies, we might be better. Before the Scottish nationalist movement, I would say that business people thought it was a bad idea because the union was like a marriage and if the divorce would cost too much money. But a big thing has happened that there's quite a number of very important businessmen, including the last chairman of the Royal Bank of Scotland, which is now coming up to be the third largest bank in the world. It was the fifth.
My goodness.
But it's taken over the Netherlands Bank just recently.
Now, Martin, when you hear this talk of Scottish pride and independence and they got their own parliament, what's going on at the same time with Wales?
Wales has an assembly which doesn't have the tax-varying powers that the Scottish government
You're
has.
More integrated into England, aren't you, than Scotland?
Yeah, I mean, that's historical. But, you know, I do put a slightly different slant on it to that which Anne said. Within the European Union, the regions have a much louder voice than ever they had before. And I think that devolution, both to Scotland and to Wales, are both a product of that. Europe is a very interesting thing. There are two forces going on there that are hard to, how can you say, reconcile to one another. Power is being sucked to a centre of European administration and power, yet at the same time, power is being pushed out, devolved from the centre to the regions, so that the Basques, the Irish...
The ethnic regions.
Yeah.
Yes.
Rather than false political creations. If you want money from Brussels, don't tell them you're doing something for Britain. Tell them you're doing something for Cornish people or Welsh people.
Well, that's right.
People.
Target one money. It's vulnerable economies. We've got a lot of European money in the Highlands and Islands because it's target one.
Ah, and you call that vulnerable economies.
Yeah.
So Europe is a free trade zone of 400 million people giving money to the weak links to make it one big healthy
new
free trade
bridges,
zone.
New bridges, ferries.
You get that in Scotland?
Absolutely.
And in Wales too?
Yeah, it's an equalisation pot.
Because every new freeway in Ireland, it comes with a European flag.
Well, it's happening in Scotland.
And
the
it
Isle
says,
of Skye.
That really means brought to you by Germany and France, doesn't it?
Well, no, because when you said that, I think I'm right in saying that Britain pays more than any other country.
So the big rich countries. Yeah, I guess Britain would be in that.
It's an equalisation pot. If you think about it on a world basis, it would pay ourselves to invest money in Mexico, in Africa.
Is it a smart move for Europe to be doing this?
I think it's a tremendously smart move because once you raise the standard of living in those less well-off countries to the point where those people don't want to come to your country, want to stay at home, develop their own strong economy, education, that's a great thing.
That diffuses the whole Irish problem, I think, because I think what motored the Irish problem was Northern Irish were afraid to go to a poor Republican Irish.
Absolutely.
They didn't care about the Catholicism so much. They just didn't want to go to a place where there's no roads and no schools. And now the Republic of Ireland is wealthier, you could argue, than Northern Ireland because of this European money, and the Northern Irish people are not so afraid.
I don't think you have to argue it. It's a fact. And I think, if nothing else, the European Union exists as an equalization mechanism, and it's going to be a great thing.
It's sort of the same wisdom that motored our Marshall Plan after World
War
II.
Absolutely.
And every American knows that was a good move. Scotland has its own pound, its own currency.
No. It's the same as the United Kingdom. We print our own notes, though.
Because you got your Scottish decorations on it.
Yes.
So you got
we
your
don't
own...
have the Queen on our notes because there's three banks, the Royal Bank, the Bank of Scotland.
You don't have the Queen on your note?
No, we've got
and she lets you do
Sir
that?
Walter Scott, and we've got Robbie Burns, and we've got our writers. And
Robbie Burns is like the ultimate in the Scottish heart,
isn't
he?
Him.
Why do you love Robbie Burns so much?
He was a man of the people. Because he wrote poetry that spoke from the heart to the people and everyone could understand him. He wrote in English and
even
in Scots.
Even today, the Scottish people love to quote Robbie. Do women quote Robbie Burns?
Oh, yes.
Give me a little Robbie Burns.
A man's a man for all that. That's a very important one because it's not your status, it's your character. That
a man's a man.
A man's a man for all that. Best laid schemes of mice of men after gang a glee. That means if you plan something, it often goes crazy.
Can you do me a little, one of these little Scottish prayers, like Robert Burns prayers?
Yes, the Celtic blessing. Some hae meat and canna eat, and some hae meat that want it. But we hae meat and we can eat, and let the Lord be thankit.
Amen. All right. Who was treated worst historically, Wales or Scotland? By the English.
Historically, what happens is that 720-odd years ago, Edward I conquered the northwest Wales. Then, over a period of time, the English king came to rule all of Wales. And so then Henry VIII decided that England is the same as Wales. Wales is the same as England. And therefore, since 1536, Wales and England have been the same. And that we were annexed to the crown
years.
Of England.
But that took a pretty strong move on Edward I's part. He built the greatest castles in Europe, I think, in northern Wales.
Yeah,
right?
That's going back 700 years. The truth about Wales is, unlike Scotland, Scotland always had a king.
And a parliament.
Kingdom of Scotland. Now, Wales did not. It was several separate small states, each violently independent of the other.
Princes.
And therefore, it could only be conquered piecemeal. And once that piecemeal conquest had happened, then it was down to Henry VIII to unify. The reason he unified is so that he could carry out his dissolution of the monasteries and the reformation of the church in Wales as he did in England. Because
that was the threat to his rule, was the church and the monasteries then.
That's right.
More than the Welsh people at that point.
That's right, because until that was as England, he had no right to dissolve those monasteries.
But Scotland was different. I mean, you have the Battle of Culloden and the English rampaging over Scotland and demanding no more Scottish language, no clans, no kilts, no bagpipes. That you must remember, and I feel that when I go to the Battle of Culloden site.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Roseanne is on the line in Albert Lee, Minnesota. Hi, Roseanne.
Hi, Greg. How are you?
Good. Thanks for your call.
Well, thank you. I'm of Welsh descent. I grew up in a small town in upstate New York, and we had no Welsh flag in our den, and my mother and father would say nostalgic at night. And I'm actually close to being full-blooded Welsh, which I find very rare to find anywhere. Like, if I ask people their ethnicity, they just say they're a blend. And so within America, those within a generation or two, you know, we lose our ethnic heritage. And I'm just wondering, how true is that of your two countries today because of Europe being so integrated? Is the ethnicity of the Welshmen and the Scotsmen of Europe as pure as it used to be?
Well, you may have noticed my name is Delewandowicz. My father was half Polish and half French. He came over on a popular trip from France, Dunkirk in 1940. Lots of people came, few went back. And my mother is half English, half Welsh. So I'm a true quadroon. I have four different races in me. And that's it. What defines your nationality to you? Is it where you were born? Is it the language you speak? Is it what your parents were? I have two sofas from IKEA. I could change my nationality to Swedish if I wanted to, but I was born in Wales. I was raised in Wales. I speak Welsh more than I speak English when I'm at home, and I simply feel Welsh. But nevertheless, and within that, I don't think there's a single reason for defining your nationality. Birth is an accident. Language is in effect an accident. Your accent is an accident. It's the way you were born and raised. I don't think we should take too much pride from that. And I'm going to. I know something about Anne's surname. Your surname, Anne Doig, where does that come from?
Well, for a long time, central Scotland, but if you go further back, apparently Germany. And I think for everybody in the UK, you go further back, there was Norse invasions, there was the Angles, the Saxons, the Celts. Celts came from somewhere.
You're kind of a melting pot, just like the United
States.
We're
a mixter-maxter, really, right. If you go further back, yeah.
We have Richard on the line in Austin, Texas. Hi, Richard. Oh, you're actually in London now, is that right?
Yeah, I'm actually in Munich right now. I'm taking a little weekend trip. I'm staying in London for the semester, staying abroad.
All right. And thanks for your call. What's your comment or question?
Oh, I was just talking about Wales. We were there recently. We had an amazing time there. Everybody was very friendly.
Great.
We did have an issue where our rental car agency did not pick us up, and it became a problem because they're all closed for the weekend, so we didn't know what we were going to do. And I went to Wales specifically to see the border collies sheep herding out in the country. And so I didn't know how we were going to get out there. And we went to the bed and breakfast, and the lady heard that we had this problem, and she said I could just take her car. which was amazing and nice of her. And so I went to go get in it, and I realized it was a manual, and I had never driven a manual before. And so thinking that was the end of it, she said, oh, well, why don't you just give it a try? And so she sat down with me and gave me a driving lesson there with her car on the crowded streets, driving around the castles and learning how to drive. So it was an amazing experience.
Now, where exactly was this?
It was in Carnarvon.
Carnarvon. You know, I live 4 miles from there.
And you learned how to drive a manual on a borrowed car from your bed and breakfast in Northern
Wales. That's typical, isn't it?
That's very...
Well, actually, I wasn't doing very well with it, and I think I was making her a little bit nervous. So finally she said, you know what, why don't I just take you out there? So she ended up driving me and my wife all the way out to Euphoria, which is about an hour drive away from Carnarvon. And she took her daughter and hopped in the car. She said, do you want to go see some sheepdogs? And she said yes. And so they hopped in the car, and we all drove out there, and she drove us all the way back.
That's a great story. Well, thank you so much for calling.
Oh, you bet. It was unbelievable. The bed and breakfast are just, that's the best way to get a travel experience, I found. The people are so nice.
I agree, and especially in Wales and Scotland, and I find Ireland too. The B&Bs are wonderful, and the people, they'll let you, I mean, you can't count on it, but I mean, if you need a ride, you'll find a ride.
Oh, often.
Also, you know, Britain is really committed to public transit, isn't it? I know in Scotland, for instance, if the buses don't go there, you're legally entitled to ride with the postman for the cost of a bus fare. Is that still true?
Oh, out in the island. Yeah, out in the rural areas. Yeah. Yeah, that's still true.
And we did that once, and it's a great way to make a friend and carry on. I'm talking with Martin Delandowitz and Anne Doig. We're studying Scotland and Wales for our upcoming travels. This is Travel with Rick Steves. I'm interested in Wales and Scotland's relationship with Ireland. Do you have an empathy for the Irish struggle? Are you a haven for even IRA people and so on? Or what's the story there?
There's been a lot of crisscrossing between Ireland and Scotland. So, yes, we've got, I think, more than Wales, perhaps, because our language came from Ireland originally. Mm-hmm. And Glasgow, there was 5,000 Irish came per week in the 1840s. So there's a lot of sympathy with what's going on in Ireland. The troubles actually spilt over to some parts of Glasgow where people took sides.
So is there actually a little bit of the troubles in Scotland? You won't find that in Wales. I don't think anybody's talking about serious secession or any kind of terrorism. But you actually have some violence in Scotland against England.
There's the Orange March parades in Glasgow celebrating the Battle of the Boyne. It's crazy.
Can you believe that? In Scotland? I didn't realize that.
Because that's how close it is. So some of it came over.
Because you got that Giant's Causeway. What is that?
Giant's Causeway.
There was a mythical causeway across connecting.
Yes, absolutely. Yes.
What about your relationship with France? I know that Scotland has Catholicism in common.
We have an old alliance with France that's never been repealed. It was a military alliance against England. And they celebrated it about 8 years ago, 600 years of the Ard Alliance.
600 years you've been allied with France against England, technically.
Yeah,
huh?
And it's never been repealed.
Because your greatest character, Mary Queen of Scots.
She was Queen of France, yeah.
And she had refuge in France, and she brought culture from France to Scotland.
Exactly. And we have things like assiette that you don't have in English, meaning a big platter from the French. We've got French words from that time.
There's fusion cuisine, isn't there?
Yes, absolutely. The Scottish food is very much influenced by France because when people ask, they want Scottish cuisine, well, it's Scottish products, but they're usually in haute cuisine in Scotland. It's usually a French interpretation of it.
Now, Scotland has had a lot of trouble over the years just because of the Catholic issue, hasn't it?
In Glasgow, I would say.
I mean, not today, but Bonnie Prince Charlie was all about Catholicism, wasn't it?
Well, he was Catholic, yes, and there was support in the Highlands. The Reformation wasn't as strong in the Highlands as it was in the rest of the country.
But wouldn't you say at the Battle of Culloden, you could as much put lines across between the two sides? One is Highland, one is Lowland. One is Catholic, one is Reformed Presbyterian.
Yeah, because the Scots they were Reformed Presbyterians who fought for the government, and the Highlanders
Presbyterians in Scotland were more likely to be working with London.
The government, because the Campbells were Presbyterians and bitter enemies of the Catholic House of Stuart, and they were Highland clan, but they fought for the government. They were Presbyterians.
And it is an irony, is it not, that while we celebrate Mary Queen of Scots, and at the same time we celebrate John Knox, we can't celebrate the two together, can we?
That's absolutely right. You got Mary Queen of Scots, who is like emblematic of Catholicism, and then John Knox, who's like Mr. Reformation.
Absolutely.
Acted directly against her. And this is the thing. Within the history of any country, there are these contradictions. And yet what happens today is we just throw them all into one bucket called history and say, oh, Mary, Queen of Scots, wasn't she lovely? And John Knox, wasn't he nice?
And they're at
odds.
You
can't have the two.
What's the state of the church today in Scotland?
They say by 2025 there'll be nobody going to church. The church is just...
So the churches are getting empty.
Absolutely getting empty, yeah.
Historically, there's a lot of very interesting history. You go to the island of Iona.
Oh, yeah, where Christianity came for spread throughout Scotland. Absolutely. And I mean, in the 19th century, I mean, Edinburgh's got hundreds of churches. There were splits in the church. People took the religious very seriously. But in the 20th century, I think it was the two world wars. People are just, they're not interested in religion anymore. So
really?
It's increasingly becoming secular.
Point. That's a good point. The death and disaster and destruction of two world wars.
Dying for God and country is the
idea. Yeah, but you know, when you have half the population, half the male population of any town or village in Scotland or indeed Wales dying, you know, it tends to make you question the goodness,
shall we say. And then Lloyd George, land fit for heroes, that never happened.
Scotland gave more per capita than England did for the
Queen.
Any
other country in Europe.
What's with that? The Scottish were so heroic in fighting the English, and then something happened in the 19th century where the first people in line were these Scottish people with their kilts and bagpipes dying in droves for the Queen.
Yeah, they expanded the British Empire because they were loyal. The Highland system was really a warrior system. The clan chiefs were like... warlords. And
so they just
Highlanders,
like to fight, in other words, and you got a chance.
The Highlanders were brave, loyal, fierce fighters. I mean, even into World War I, the Germans called them the women from hell because they wore the kilt.
Is that right?
Yeah. And the Scots regiment saved Paris in World War I. Nobody knows about it. That's the kind of thing that we get a bit upset about. When Britain does something well, it's England. And when Scotland does something well, it's Britain. And then nobody hears about it. So...
There's a lovely story that comes from Wales, that it comes from the 14th century, where the king is interesting. He's holding an inquiry. By what right do you raise that money? By what right do you hold that land? And the Earl of Pembroke came in, and everybody was producing their title deeds. The Earl of Pembroke walked in with a rusty sword, banged it on the table and said, it is by this right that I hold my land. And it's the same thing in Scotland, wasn't it, exactly? These were feudal lords.
Yes,
they held
right.
land by power, and their tenants were their army. And mm-hmm. loyalty was a strong thing. They ate together and they
fought
together.
It was a feudal system.
Come the 19th century, when the feudal ruler was the queen, they were loyal to the Queen.
Exactly.
Loyal to the Queen. Plus the fact that if you look, I mean, I started
They wanted off jobs, with, too.
Yeah, this is
sure.
it.
They joined the army.
Thin, acid soil and small sheep. So what are you going to do for money?
You go to the National Museum on Edinburgh Castle for the military. Fascinating museum. And the propaganda is so powerful. Mm. Talking all of these Scottish kids into fighting for the Queen and
Absolutely.
Going to foreign lands for the glory of God and country.
It's very
and
ironic because...
And there's even signing bonuses, just like we have today in our country.
Yeah. I mean, it's very ironic because their fathers and grandfathers fought against that system.
Yeah, exactly.
And then the romanticism of Scotland, everyone wearing the kilt, and it had been banned. It was ethnic cleansing. But the 19th century, Queen Victoria, Walter Scott, everybody wearing the kilt,
the
making
Black
it
Watch.
Fashionable.
Part of it, you know, Queen Victoria ruled for, what, 70 years or something?
37 to 1901, 1837 to 1901.
Okay, 64 years something she ruled. That. And she was infatuated with the wild, kilted Scotsmen, I think. I think she must have had wonderful dreams about them or something.
Yes,
I mean, that was
Scotland.
Her thing, wasn't it? Now the English royal family still holidays up in Balmoral.
Absolutely. The royal family loves Scotland.
But that was going on throughout Europe, wasn't it? That's Richard Wagner.
Okay, that's the romantic
era.
I guess that makes sense, the underdog, the ethnic underdog.
Well, it's also the industrialization and the urbanization. What happens is people look for their rural roots that they never had.
It's a natural consequence of that. Now, the Welsh, I mean, when I think of you guys fighting, I think you guys fighting in lifeboats against storms to rescue people out on boats.
Oh, come on, everybody's seen the film Zulu, haven't they? Where the South Wales borderers hold out against all those Zulus. They're talking about propaganda as well.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah.
But you got this thing about lifeboats.
Have we?
You do. Everywhere I go, there's a charity for the lifeboats.
Oh, yeah, because Britain's an island, and we've got a particularly rocky coast, as has Scotland. Now, the lifeboats in Britain, I don't know about America, but it's run entirely voluntarily.
Right.
It's public subscription, and it's the one charity that you go into the pub, the hardest, worst drinker, the meanest man, he'll put money in for the lifeboat because he never knows when he's going to need it.
Is that right?
Oh, yeah.
So in our country, the firemen have we're really thankful for the firemen to help
Absolutely.
Us out and so on. In Wales, I feel like the lifeboat volunteers are kind of in that same category.
Within the town, if you're in the lifeboat crew, you're a respected person. You're giving your time, risking your life for the well-being of others, which is a very wonderful thing to do.
It sure is. We've got lots of callers on the line. This is Travel with Rick Steves. I'm talking with Martin Delandowitz and Anne Doig, and we're talking about Wales and Scotland as it relates to the British Empire. And we have Catherine on the line in Wilmington, Delaware. Hi, Catherine.
Hi, Rick. How are you?
Good. Thanks for your call. Do you have a question or a comment for Martin or Anne?
I would like to ask out of curiosity what each of your guests, what their favorite aspect of the opposite country is.
Oh, very nice. This is like having a political candidate make a compliment to the other one. Okay.
Well, the opposite, my favorite thing about Wales, Port Merion.
Really?
The villages, the beaches, the landscape.
Port Merion is Italian, isn't it?
It's Italianate. It's Clough Williams Ellis.
So it's like a folly. It's a big Italian...
It's a village built between the two world wars. Italianate, they say. But,
so Anne is complimenting Wales for something that's the only thing Italian in Wales. That's not a very good compliment. Martin, your turn.
Well, if Anne mentioned it, I'm going to say it now. I admire deeply Scottish education. Scottish education is the highest standard in Britain. Their universities and their academies, their schools are phenomenal. Of course, they've produced such wonderful people as Tony Blair and, of course, our current Prime Minister, Gordon Brown. What an estimable educational system.
So they're both educated in Scotland?
Yes, Tony Blair, a good Edinburgh man.
Tony Blair was made in Edinburgh, absolutely.
Made in Edinburgh.
He was born there and educated there.
All right. Thanks for your comment, Catherine, or your question.
It's true that, by the way, Anne. I admire Scottish education hugely.
I've learned a lot about Scottish education when I'm up there.
Phenomenal.
It's just really impressive, and people don't realize that. But it does go back to the Reformation and a lot of things. There's historical roots to that.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of Scots and Welsh emigration outside of your zones. I mean, any poor region has more people leaving it than others. Mm. And if you look at who came to America, it was the people who had the toughest times. Where's the where did the immigrants go from Scotland and Wales?
In Wales in particular, the Quakers around Bala. This is at the time when, you know, William of Orange, we talked about the Battle of the Boyne, came in, and everybody in Britain had to swear an oath of fealty to the king. Well, Quakers don't swear oaths. And so the Welsh Quakers picked up sticks and were promised a Welsh tract by William Penn. But now,
Pennsylvania was mostly Welsh Quakers?
No, it was other people too. Mm-hmm. But a man called William Humphreys left his house in Bala, came along to Wales, and built a replica of his farmhouse in Pennsylvania. And his farmhouse was called Bryn Mawr. So that's where you get place Bryn Mawr, that great lady's college. And so that's straight from Wales.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
And a lot of the names, you know, Balacunwyd and all the rest of it, very Welsh.
Scottish immigration?
The Carolinas originally, North Carolina, Nova Scotia, Australia, South America, and it's still happening. My sister lives in the States, and I lived abroad for a while, too.
And now with the hot economies in Britain, I find when I went to Cardiff with my TV show, I wanted to shoot some Welsh people,
and
it was hard to find Welsh people. I mean, there was immigrants
new
there.
Immigration.
The new Welsh people.
Yeah.
So you have a lot of immigrants.
Eastern Europeans. But I don't know about Wales, but in Scotland, we've got a lot of Eastern Europeans.
Yeah, in Cardiff, you get them. Isn't Cardiff a beautiful city, Rick? Didn't you find the civic buildings gorgeous?
I have a tough time in Cardiff, to be honest with you.
Why is that, Rick?
I don't know. Why is it? Why do I have a tough time in Cardiff? It's a historic city.
Next time you come, you go with me. We'll have a great time.
Carnarvon is your home, right, Martin?
Yep.
Carnarvon with a great castle.
Beautiful castle. The most expensive castle ever built by a king of England.
Before we get into fine castles, and it is true, that castle has a sort of a stylish touch, doesn't it?
Oh, it does.
The nice inlaid stonework. But what about the tacky cultural cliches? I find them, frankly, kind of obnoxious. When I go to Scotland, it's like Loch Ness Monsterville. There's the original Loch Ness Monster Center and the official Loch Ness Monster Center, and they each have more square footage devoted to their shops than to the actual museum site. What's your take on that, Anne? Because you are Scottish.
Yes, I am Scottish, and the monsters given birth to a million tacky tourist items. I can't stand those tacky tourist items, but
it pays the bills.
Exactly. Because, you know, Norway's invented a monster, too.
Is that right?
Iron monsters goes back to the time of St. Columba, though.
That's true. It's a historic cultural cliché.
Yeah. There's been 10,000 sightings, the mystery of the loch.
The historic hoax.
But, in fact, I don't think it's the most beautiful loch. And
What is the most beautiful loch, would you say?
Loch Maree, in my opinion, which is further north.
How do you spell that?
M-A-R-E-E, which... Yeah. In my opinion, in Wester Ross is the most beautiful loch.
Martin, what's the most obnoxious tourist trap in Wales, as far as you're concerned?
Oh, guys, you know, there are lots of contenders here, Rick. I couldn't answer that if anybody from the Wales Tourist Board were listening. Then.
Nobody from the Wales Tourist Board
From the Tourist Board is listening, and then I would go for Hril.
Really, why?
Because it expresses possibly the worst of what I mean, this is purely my opinion. Right. I do apologize to anybody listening from Thrill or indeed from the Wales Tourist Board. It's sort of Coney Island without the warmth, you know?
You know, I went to Llandudno.
Yes.
No, what is the resort town just past
Llandudno,
Conway?
Yeah, Llandudno. It's really nice.
It's a glorious Victorian resort,
and
right?
That's
turn
the
of the
point.
Century kind of. And it's elegant. There's an old world elegance when people really thought they could walk out on a pier and get the sea air.
Llandudno is in effect Thrill without Coney Island. And isn't it nice? Seaside resorts do not have to be awful. Oh, we've got places like towns with 57 names in them.
Tell me the name. There's that one, and that's one of my pet peeves. Everybody wants to go to this town, and it just has a long name.
What does it have? Yeah, it has a long name.
So you go to the train station, and you read on the front of the train station, what do you read?
Llanfair Pwllgwyngyllgogeri Chwyrndro Bwllantisilio Gogogoch.
Wonderful.
That's the name of the town?
Yep, that's the name of the town.
It must be a whole bunch of words put
together.
It's
a whole bunch of words. It's,
do you know what it means?
The Church of St. Mary, Rapid, Whirlpool, Hollow, Hazel, blah, blah. It's a 19th century fiction. I'm going to tell you this now.
Yeah.
It's very much like Welsh national costume was invented in the 1860s and 70s. A lot of our traditions, we talked about the romantic period when people looked for roots that never existed, and a lot of our cultural traditions were then invented.
All over Europe. Tourists should know. Half of the sightseeing they see is an invention from the romantic age. Mm-hmm. A lot of the towns all over Europe that are so charming and higgly-piggly and so on were fanciful rebuilds over the top. Based on some kind of medieval reality, but done over the top in the 19th century.
And what annoys
Victorian
me,
Gothic. Yeah.
Yeah, what annoys me about these is that out there is a far better truth. The reality of Scotland or Wales is far better than the Loch Ness Monster, isn't it?
Oh, of course.
Oh, yes.
And you know, it takes a bit more finding because the Loch Ness Monster is so available. But if you if you go and look for the real history, the real past of Scotland or Wales, it is far more interesting. It lasts better.
But there's a symptom. I think a lot of the tourist industry would find it more convenient if travelers were just dumbed down and they do this stuff. You make more money, it's right there, it's simple, it's a slam dunk. You got your Loch Ness Monster toy, let's go on to the next tourist cliche. And they're missing some real exciting learning that they could have in their travels. Cindy's on the line from Warren, Michigan. Hi, Cindy, thanks for your call.
Oh, thank you, Rick. Hi, how are you?
We're doing good.
Good. I was wondering, on Wales, is there any type of agritourism there?
Agrotourism. Well, we have the bed and breakfast. And by agrotourism, I think you maybe mean staying at farmhouses. Yes, there's quite a lot of
it. Is that what you mean, Cindy?
Yes, I do. Like Italy, I think, is very popular.
That's
for
right, agrotourism. And it's the same thing. What has happened is that I've said already that Wales, like Scotland, has thin, acid soil and small sheep. In other words, the land is not too productive. Farmers try to diversify. And one of the things they do is they have tourists, visitors to Wales, stay at their places. And Welsh farmhouses, there are many Welsh farmhouses that you can stay at. And it's a lovely experience.
And Welsh sheepdog demonstrations on farms.
Yeah, indeed. I mean,
I
the same in Scotland. Yeah, same in Scotland. Border collies are the traditionally used dog. And it's wonderful to see. I mean, farming in Wales is tough, as it is in Scotland. It's hard. It's not a great climate.
Does the government subsidise that to save small farms, or is it just tough luck?
No, they're still good. Not as good as they used to be. Again, this we were talking about the European Union. There are subsidies to be had from the European Union that make it bearable. But believe me, it is a true vocation.
But London does recognise the value of keeping the small farms alive as part of the heritage, and they do get a few breaks.
Oh, yes.
But a lot of small farmers are doing touristic things, like our friend who has the dog demonstration in Northern Wales.
Absolutely. Yeah, true.
And he probably makes as much money showing tourists his dog responding to his whistles as he does cutting the hair off his sheep.
I mean, the farmers are now really becoming custodians of the landscape. They don't make money out of their farming efforts.
But, you know, I mean, it is. We sort of mock it. But tourism is a great value to areas like Wales and Scotland, countries like Wales and Scotland.
Absolutely.
Because our climates and our soils do not produce much.
Cindy, you've travelled in Wales before?
Yes, we just went across the bridge and went to Tintern Abbey and I believe a castle there.
Yeah, Chepstow
Castle. It was just
castle,
beautiful, but I wanted to explore it a little bit more and I was thinking agritourism would be the way to go.
What a good idea. You've really got a good idea there, Cindy.
Yeah. And you cut over from Bath then or some places,
yes.
Right?
Yeah,
so many
right
people
off.
Go to Bath in the Cotswold villages and I think you're really smart, Cindy, to just take that quick freeway over the huge bridge.
Oh, it was wonderful.
And
it was so quick, like you said.
Tintern Abbey is just beautiful. And then you've got Carefully Castle there, which is quite dramatic.
Chepstow Castle.
Very nice. And avoid the big city just down the road.
Cardiff.
Yes.
A lovely city. Wonderful.
I quite enjoyed it.
I'm glad you did, Cindy.
There is a great site just beyond Cardiff at St. Fagans.
St. Fagans, the folk museum.
The open-air folk museum. And here where you get traditional culture on a Lazy Susan.
Yeah. Oh, OK. okay. Now, they do have, like, long boats like England does?
No, what it is they brought buildings representative of the architectural heritage of all of Wales to the one site near the capital city, Cardiff. And it's a Swedish model originally, the folk mm-hmm. village. You see one in Holland too, don't you?
All over Europe now, you have yeah. these open-air folk museums. But here's an example, Cindy. You would go, they've got a long strip of row houses, two up and
That's
two
right,
down, whatever
yeah.
they call it. And each one, you got eight houses in a row. Each okay. one would be dolled up and furnished as it was in a different generation going back 150 years. So you walk right down this little strip yeah. of apartments and you go into the living rooms from 1840, 1880, 1920, yeah. 1960. It's really quite fascinating.
Oh, it's yeah. beautiful.
And that would be an open-air folk museum. You've got them all over Britain. Britain is really into that sort of thing.
Oh, okay.
Cindy, thanks for your call.
Oh, thank you so much.
What about alcohol? In Scotland, of course, we got the whiskey.
Yes.
How is Scottish and Irish whiskey different?
Irish is distilled three times, I think.
Scottish
is twice.
And it's spelled different too, right?
Yeah, there's an E in the Irish one. Ours is the best, of course, but they'll have a discussion. They'll disagree with
of
that.
Of course the Irish will. If you're going for Scottish whiskey as a tourist, how will you get the fun whiskey experience? What do you advise?
Going to distillery.
Go to a distillery and you tour the distillery and you get a tasting.
You get a tasting,
They actually have a tasting test at the end, which is fun.
That's right, yeah.
And if you want to go to a pub, many people go to a pub for a beer, but boy, those pubs are into their whiskeys too.
Oh, yeah. Some of the pubs got a huge amount of selection of whiskies.
How many different whiskies do you know the figure offhand?
There's over 300.
No, right. So
different single malts.
Now, at the top, everybody goes to Edinburgh. At the top of the Royal Mile, you got what we call Malt Disney. It's just this goofy
the whiskey Heritage Centre, yeah.
At the bottom, there's a place called Cadenheads.
Cadenheads. That's excellent. That's
why do you like
best.
Cadenheads?
Because it's a real thing.
It's a guy who pulls it out of the keg, and he really knows his stuff, and he'll bottle you something. And he told me that all these guys whose names are on the labels of the whiskey bottles, the big barons of whiskey, they prefer the unfiltered. And it's this whiskey in the rough.
Yeah.
And you get it there at Cadenheads.
Yeah, they don't, because some whiskies they actually add caramel to keep the color consistent.
Yeah, it's a horrible thing what they do for the mass production of the whiskies.
And you can join temporarily as the Malt Whiskey Society in Queen Street in Leith. Uh-huh. And you can buy from them, and it's from a cask.
Now, in Wales, all they have is mead.
No, we got beer too. We're actually very fond of beer. I want to point out that Southwest Scotland by Glasgow has the highest incidence of crime and disease related to alcohol. But in Britain, Wales is proudly number two.
In what?
In alcohol-related
disease. So you do have an alcohol problem.
No problem. We can buy it fairly cheap. It's not a huge problem.
Okay, so if you have a problem with violence, I mean, it's just
I know, it is. It's a sad thing, yeah.
So, but mead is a medieval honey wine, right?
Mead, and yes, in the poems of Aneurin of the mid-6th century, medd, the Welsh word for mead, was being distilled and drunk back then and remembered in poetry. Mead is still distilled and drunk.
I love the Welsh language. What language do they speak up in heaven?
Well, it is said that Welsh is the language of heaven, but I doubt that seriously.
You doubt that
That's
seriously?
That's funny, because they said that the words that were spoken in the Garden of Eden was Gaelic.
Yeah. Isn't that strange, isn't it?
What was Shakespeare's first language?
It was English, but a different English to the
Anglo-Saxon,
one we know.
Anglo-Saxon, yeah.
Apparently there are 6 autographs that survive of Shakespeare's, and each time it's spelt differently. And these are autographs. So anybody listening who cannot spell or has difficulty spelling, don't worry about it. Shakespeare couldn't do it either, even with his own name.
That's brilliant.
We're talking with Martin and Anne about Wales and Scotland. You got bagpipes in both of your countries, don't you?
Yes.
No, not really.
Not bagpipes in
no.
Wales?
It died out, maybe, because they say there was a tradition of bagpipes in every European country.
Well, I guess in Wales it's harps.
Well, no, we had something called the pipgon, which was, it's like a cross between a recorder and a clarinet that sounds like a bee in the final throes of its
dying
death.
Bee, okay.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But in Wales, when you think about music, it's male choirs.
It's male
it's
choirs.
Choirs.
Not yeah. female choirs.
Yeah, wow. You do get female choirs. The male choirs are there. The female choirs are a later thing because, you see, that's, again, essentially 19th century.
That's the male choirs is where it has the roots in the
coal mines.
In the coal mines and in the factories, but it's only in the 19th century when you really start coal mining or in factories that choirs will then develop. Men will come together.
So for the last 150 years or something,
200 years,
you've had men. And how does that why do choirs have anything to do with coal mining?
Well, because people would work together, they would sing together, and then they would establish competitions between the different sections of the pit, or between different pits, between different chapels, between different villages, and people would practice at lunchtime. The Eisteddfodau, you know, the festivals of poetry and culture, grew out of that chapel industrial culture, really. All right, they'd existed since the 1200s.
For a tourist, Martin, visiting Wales today, who's interested in hearing some good male choirs, what would you advise?
I would advise the two things you'd do is, usually it's Tuesday, Wednesday, you'll find that all choirs, and there's a choir, if you're in Wales, there's a choir near you, and they practice on Tuesday and Wednesday nights, and that's really good to go to, and it doesn't cost you, make a contribution. And of course, you can go down to the pub afterwards with the choristers, and those tired throats do need lubrication. But I tell you this, if you go down the pub with the choir, off come the collars and ties, and their singing is fantastic.
This is a great tip. So Tuesday and Wednesday, choirs practice.
Usually, yeah.
In almost every town, they've got a choir. And it's a social thing. Every week they get together.
Oh, yeah.
And they'll practice, I suppose, at the church?
No, it can be the church. It's usually some hall somewhere in town.
A hall. And then as part of the whole social thing, they go down to the pub together.
Afterwards,
naturally.
Yeah. And the singing, oh.
And then the singing really gets going.
Yeah.
And then a tourist would be welcome there?
Absolutely.
It's a beautiful thing. A beautiful thing. We've got some more people on the line. We got Nadine on the line in Chehalis, Washington. Hi, Nadine.
Hi, Rick. I'm a weaver and a musician, and I'm drawn to go to Scotland most every year. But if I want to expand my travels to Wales, I'm wondering if Martin could tell me what pubs I could go to play some music with some locals and see venues related to textiles.
Hmm. Right. Now, you can combine both of those in the fair town of Conwy in North Wales. One of our last callers was staying up there looking at the castle. What you do is that, now, you're going to have to forgive me. I've forgotten the name of the pub. What instrument do you play there, Nadine?
The fiddle.
Well, you have that pub in Conwy. Every Monday night is a folk evening, and you'd be most welcome. And just up the valley, I would say, if you were to drive 10 minutes, there is a woolen mill. And it's not like one of these shops where they sell you bits of wool. They actually manufacture. They mill wool there. So you can combine the two. Only travelling 10 minutes.
The woolen mills.
What's the name of the mill?
It is the Trefriw, T-R-E-F. R-I-W. The other one you could look at, now that's a, that would take you an hour to get there, is, I'll spell it to you rather than, it's Brynkir, but B-R-Y-N-K-I-R. They have machinery so old that if you go to the Museum of the Welsh Woolen Industry, you see the same machinery as a museum piece that they're actually using there.
Nadine, thanks for your call.
Excellent, thanks.
Martin and Anne, I've got just a short time left. I'd like to get your comments on this in just a couple of sentences each. There's a famous line that defines each of your regions, Offa's Dyke in Wales and Hadrian's Wall in Scotland. Offa's Dyke, Martin.
Offa's Dyke. Offa was an English king. And what he, you see, the word Wales means, well, Walia, foreigner. And Wales didn't exist as a word in Wales. To the Anglo-Saxons, to the English who came in after the Roman conquest, they're just the strangers. And do you know, Wales has never had anything. So they come over into Mercia and they'd rob mercilessly. And this king, Offa, said, to heck with this. And so he organised all the people along the border of Wales. They dug a big ditch, threw the product of the ditch into a bank. This bank and ditch then defined geographically Wales for the first time. This is in the 800s.
And you can hike it today?
You can hike it. Bits of it survive quite well, bits not.
Hadrian's Wall.
Hadrian's Wall was built by the Emperor Hadrian in about AD 140 to mark the end of the British Empire. North of that were the barbarians. That was my ancestors.
And the Romans decided, let's not mess with them. They look like more trouble than they're worse. High mountains. Well, Britain doesn't have towering mountains, but you got mountains you're proud of. In Wales, you got Mount Snowdon. In Scotland, you got Ben Nevis. Tell me about Ben Nevis.
4,406 feet means the Ben or the Hill of Heaven. It's near Fort William, and everyone wants to climb it and scatter their ancestors
tallest
on it.
Tallest point in all of the British Isles?
The tallest point in all of the British Isles, yeah.
Wow. And Mount Snowdon?
Snowdon, 3,654 feet high. It's 500 feet less, but it's beautiful. It really is. Snowdon Ear, the range of hills around it, really lovely. Dropping into the sea, therefore having the feeling of being much higher than they really are.
Yeah, Ben Nevis drops into the sea as well, which is good.
We've got a beautiful comment from Mimi, who emailed us from Cincinnati. Mimi writes, Scotland is amazing, especially Culloden and the Great Glen. And Wales is mystical, magical, and I get an amazing feeling of belonging there, even if I'm not Welsh. Thoughts on that?
That's a lovely thing to say, isn't it? And that's the thing. You know, our listeners will, of course, want to go to Scotland. I don't blame them. They'll want to go to Wales. And what has been said by Mimi tells you that a welcome awaits you in both those places.
That's a very sweet sentiment. I think there's also a fun little playful jabbing among the family of ethnic groups that share those British islands. Anne, is there any sort of wisdom that you can tell me?
There's a little poem. It illustrates our humour, I guess. But it starts with, "First you have the Welsh who pray on their knees and on their neighbours. Then you have the Irish who don't know what they want, but they'll fight you for it anyway. Then you have the Scots who keep the Sabbath and everything else they can get their hands on. And then you have the English, who are a self-made race, which absolves Almighty God of a great deal of responsibility."
Wow, that's a thought-provoking mouthful. And words to ponder as we close this hour. Anne and Martin from Scotland and Wales, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Rick.
Thank you.
Rick Steves has spent a third of his adult life in Europe, researching and writing guidebooks. His now classic, Europe Through the Back Door, teaches the skills of smart travel. At Rick Steves' online travel store, you'll also find guidebooks for London, England, Great Britain, and Ireland. To learn more about Rick's guidebooks for Britain, Ireland, and beyond, visit the travel store at ricksteves.com.